This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. On May 16, 1989, at 8 o'clock in the morning, hearing room 343, we'll be conducting a work session on the following House bills, 2167 and 3089, conducting public hearing and possible work session on the following House bills, 2415, 2421A, 2429A, 2573A, 2667A, 2764, 2757, 2930, 3068,
3094, 3455A. Let's come to order. Senator Shoemaker is on his way. Senator Springer will I think is going to be excused from water policy. We need to make sure that he is. Let's take up House Bill 2757. Representative Hostica is here. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for letting me go first. My name is Carl Hostica. For the record, I'm a state representative from District 40 in Lane County. I'll briefly explain why the bill is here, and then I have one proposed change. The bill is here because of a problem that has been perceived with the state open meetings law, and that is that when you look at the law as it currently exists, it prescribes a lot of procedures that people have to go through, but does not provide any sanction for violation of the open meetings law. And in our area of the state, at least, there have been a number of glaring violations that have gotten people stirred up. And the concern was, well, if the public bodies violate it, then what happens to them? And the general idea is nothing really happens to them unless somebody goes to court, and then a court can find whatever they want. So I was thinking about this and working with some people in my area and came up with an idea that I thought was a very simple idea. And we found out that the idea was so simple that only the lawyers could complicate it. And the simple idea was that if the governing body of a public agency violated the open meetings law, then it would be as if they had not made the decision. Decision would be void. And I still think that was a good idea, but we had to work it through several combinations and permutations with the House Judiciary Committee to come up with what is before you is the engrossed House Bill 2757, which continues to preserve the concept that if a decision is made in violation of the open meetings law, it shall be voidable. But in the initial instance, it won't be voided if the body goes back and redoes the decision by following the open meetings law. And then we also indicated it would be the date of initial adoption. And the main concern here was with a number of local governments that decisions to let contracts or to issue financial instruments and things like that, which have dates attached to them, that could be voided would be in severe difficulty unless we provided the opportunity to reinstate those decisions effective from the initial date. The bill then goes on to say that the conditions under which a court would void a decision would be if the violation was a result of intentional disregard of the law or willful misconduct by a quorum of the members, and that was to protect the situation from technical violations, because the open meetings law is full of technical kinds of issues regarding who has to receive notice and when it has to be given and how minutes have to be kept. So that the essence of the bill is to look at intentional, willful actions by the governing body itself, and then finally indicating that the decision would be voided unless other equitable relief is available, and that's the part that I would propose some amendment to today. Finally, we wanted to have a period of time beyond which a person couldn't come in and charge that the open meetings law had been violated, and the House Judiciary Committee decided on 60 days following the date that the decision becomes a public record since if a decision was made in violation of open meetings law, nobody would actually know when it had been made, so that the point at which the clock would start ticking would be the point at which the decision became a public record. I think that given all the changes that were made in the House, that we have a bill then that is clean and deals with most of the concerns of the local governments, but still preserves the concept that members of governing bodies should not violate the open meetings law with impunity, and that there would be a rather stiff sanction in the event that they violated it willfully or intentionally, and that would be that their decisions would not have any effect. Would suggest to the committee one possible change, and that has to do with the way that the first part of subsection 3 is written there. It says that a court finds that the court shall void the decision of a governing body if the court finds that the violation was in result of it, was the result of intentional disregard or willful misconduct. Then there's a period, and then there's another sentence that says a decision shall be voided unless other equitable relief is available. Some, again, legal types have indicated some confusion with what the meaning of having two sentences there is, and so that in order to avoid confusion and to be more consistent with, at least I believe, my original intent in introducing the bill, it would be, the suggestion would be to insert a comma at the end of line 15 instead of the period, and then delete the first five words, a decision shall be voided, in line 16, so it would read that the court shall void the decision unless other equitable relief is available, meaning that still that if there were some other way that the court could find to resolve it that was judged to be equitable, then the court could do that rather than void the decision. But I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair. I've been through a lot with this bill on the House side, and I don't know how much more we have to go through on the Senate side. I think we have a pretty good vehicle right now.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
I want to see if I understand this correctly. If there's a, call it inadvertent violation of the public meetings law, then if the governing body reinstates the decision while in compliance. Uh-huh. Now, what does that mean exactly? Does that just mean that they, in an open meeting, would disclose the fact that there was a technical violation and in that open meeting move to correct it? Or do
that
you mean that they have to start over and with notice and
well, I believe it would be that they would have to start over with the notice provisions that are within the regular part of the law, because the essence of the open meeting law and the notice provisions in the minutes is for the public to know in advance that something is going to happen or is likely to happen, and then to know afterwards that it did happen.
Okay, so they in effect start over?
Essentially.
How does that differ then from the voiding if the violation was the result of was intentional?
It differs. Well, no, it doesn't differ in a sense. There's the conditions under which you can reinstate don't matter whether it's technical or willful. You could still reinstate even if you were willful, but that the essence of the reinstatement is idea rather than just saying that you're going de novo is that you have an effective date from the initial adoption.
So you still have to go through the whole drill of,
right.
of doing it right from the beginning, but it would date back. Okay.
Right, yeah, the effective date could be back to the original time.
Okay, but in every case, there's another way to deal with the problem through other equitable relief. You could pursue that.
Well. Are there other questions? Well, so as one who started out with something like this some years ago, I'm interested to see that you've gotten it this far, Carl.
Well, I'd like to see it go further, Madam Chair.
And we have the amendments, Catherine, right?
I don't know if you have my proposed amendments.
Okay,
I can give them to you in handwritten
them.
Form.
Right. Thanks. Then we'll be back, we'll be in touch with you and call Karen Hafner unless there are other questions of Representative Pasca. Come on up, Karen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Hafner. I represent the Oregon School Boards Association. Basically, I wanted to indicate our support, the local government, a group of local government representatives met with Representative Pasca, and we feel that we have worked out a bill that would actually improve the public meetings law. And we also support the Representative Pasca's amendment. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of us. Let's start. Let's, are you ready with work session, Catherine, on 2167?
Yes, Senator.
Almost ready. Before we either lose Senator Brenneman or 2167, we'll take the two work session bills. Senator Springer is here and in demand in both places, apparently.
I got a chair of the water from that.
Yeah.
It's number 6. I'm not much.
Thank you.
Is he sick?
Okay. Yeah, he's been sick for 2 days. Thank you.
I've got one of my people here.
Great. Thanks.
Leave me holler.
Okay, this 2167 is the bill that authorizes the State Board of Psychologist Examiners, the Board of Optometry, and the Board of Naturopathic Physicians. That's the group that it applies to. It provides that information provided to for a psychologist. Any information provided under their whole enabling chapter is confidential. It includes licensing, unauthorized practice, sanctions, and discipline sections. For the Board of Optometry, it refers to the discipline section, and for the Board of Naturopaths, to the discipline section. What the bill provides is that information provided to those groups is confidential, not subject to public disclosure, not admissible as evidence in judicial proceedings. It also provides anyone who gives information in good faith is not subject to civil liability. And there are no amendments.
Question.
Senator Grinsky.
Does this mean if I I'm interested in determining whether I have a competent optometrist or psychologist, and I call one of these boards and I want to know whether there's ever been a complaint that they're not going to tell me? Is that what that means?
I believe if an order is final, that information would be public information. If you called and asked if they'd ever been disciplined.
Well, it says the information provided to them is confidential.
Yeah. Right.
So I think it's pretty clear that you, that they would be able to, they would release that a complaint has been filed. The purpose here, if I recall, and is there anyone here from the boards or from the executive department who wanted this filed, was to preserve the parties who gave information and their. Where were those? Senator Brockman.
I made a note here on the bill when we had the hearing on it. It says all other health care provider boards have similar language, but these three do not.
Yeah, I think that's really what we're doing here.
Madam Chair, I'm aware that the physicians have a similar protection, and also by virtue of, well, there's a bill in the session that would extend the same to emergency medical technicians. I think it's appropriate that there be protection. I guess I'm a little, I want to be sure that these provisions really track the same protections that are offered to physicians and don't expand it. And I wonder if anyone has made that analysis, because these are much more concise than the physicians' provisions. And without sitting down and really kind of comparing the two, I'm not totally comfortable that
Senator, after the last hearing, I looked at the dental board and the Board of Medical Examiners and just made short notes about what those statutes provided. I can review that if you wish. I didn't just sit down and compare them, but maybe it's on it.
Okay, let's be quick.
Okay, for the dental board, there's immunity when using consultants to improve services, investigate complaints. They're also subject to the public laws of confidentiality. And there's no liability if they're acting without malice. This one says if they act in good faith, so that's one significant difference. There's also a duty to report violations to the dental board, and ORS 679310 says that no person who has made a complaint to the board shall be answerable for any such act in any proceeding except for perjury. That's the Board of Dental Examiners. So that is somewhat different. The Board of Medical Examiners, these are my notes on ORS 677335. Members of the board, members of its administrative investigative staff, its attorneys, acting as prosecutors or counsel, shall have the same privilege and immunities from civil and criminal proceedings arising by reams of official action.
Okay, but I want to stop. That's not relevant to this bill, because, is it?
Well.
What we're talking about here is information being confidential that's provided. We're not talking about liability of the board members.
What's that statutory reference again, Commissioner?
677335.
Isn't this when someone, maybe another person in that profession or a patient or someone who knows someone practicing in one of these professions, this person makes a complaint against someone practicing to the board?
Right.
And then maybe in the course of the investigation, the board finds out that the charge is erroneous. The person being charged couldn't go back and sue that person for making the complaint to the board.
And so it doesn't have anything, Catherine, it has nothing,
I don't think
this
it
bill
provides
has nothing
anything
to say
for a member
liability.
Controlled by board.
Look at the bill.
It
says.
Any person who in good faith provides information to the board is not subject to an action for civil damages.
But
right.
we're not talking about liability of board members or officials.
All right, Senator, part of that same statute says persons reporting to those board members are immune except for perjury. That was the second part of that statute.
I understand that, but why are we talking about the first part then?
Because it was written down.
Okay.
Anyway. All right. And then the other ORS for the medical board is 677450, which says information provided to the board in good faith shall not be subject to public disclosure nor used as evidence in a judicial proceeding.
That's the comparable one.
We don't deal with the judicial proceedings at all in this current
confidential
bill.
Confidential and not because of public disclosure.
It just says.
Wait a minute. I think. Okay. The one difference then is that in the 677425, which deals with physicians, and as you quoted it from the nurses, there is a good faith requirement. So to impose that same limitation here, we would amend.
We have good faith on line 8.
Oh, you're right. Any person who in good faith.
And we have good faith in 14, and
yeah,
we have good faith
it's
in 20.
It's in a different place. That's right. I didn't see it.
So I guess.
I think you're okay. I think we're okay. I think it does do it. Okay.
Good. Everybody's ready?
Madam Chair.
Senator Brennan.
I'll move the bill out of committee and the floor with a due pass.
Senator Brennan moves House Bill 2167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Let's move to 3089.
Yes, Senator, this is the bill that Representative Bunn testified on and sponsored. It allows the court discretion to waive the bond requirements if all heirs and devisees agree to waiver. And it requires a signed agreement about the waiver, which must be filed with the court at the time the personal representative is appointed.
Madam Chair, I had one
right.
question about that, and I think I raised it with a witness, and that is, requiring a waiver from all heirs could be quite a burden. You may not be able to locate all heirs,
right.
particularly in an intestate.
Right.
proceeding, and maybe we ought to give some discretion to the court to modify that requirement.
Well.
Senator Grinsky.
Seems to me that there needs to be some kind of reasonableness standard built in, because people never know for sure if all the devisees and heirs have been contacted. You don't even know who they are.
Well, you know the devisees because they're named, but you wouldn't know the heirs.
Right, okay, but the heirs, you don't know necessarily if there are other heirs that might take on this thing theoretically. So how would that even be applied in a practical situation? How would the court know if everyone signed it?
Well, that's my problem.
Probably some affidavit that the personal representative would file indicating that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Brennan.
Under those circumstances, if you couldn't locate them, why not just operate under the current system then, provide the bond? I mean, this is really designed, I think, in certain cases, to waive the bond as a cost-saving measure if everyone's saying, let's do it. I think that's kind of the thrust of the bill, isn't it? Offer an option, it'll just, if everyone agrees to it, it's going to save money.
At least that was my sense of it. And I guess I'll probably, because I'm not as familiar with the operations of those kinds of court of proceedings as much, I think we almost could effectively take away most of the bond if you, on a regular basis, if you got a court that said, well, you got 3/4 of the people, we think you got everybody, you don't need a bond, and then you leave out a few people who aren't covered or that they haven't been diligent enough about. And I guess I'd rather go this first step and pass the bill as it is without extending it further.
Of course.
But part of it is because I may not be as familiar with the operations of how that all works.
Well, the court, in any case, it's discretionary. In other words, even if you've reached all the heirs, the court still will waive the bond in its discretion.
Right.
So it's going to make a judgment about having to do with the size of the estate, probably, and some sense of the reliability of the people that are involved. And I think a court can be entrusted with that. I guess I might suggest that after the word heirs, we put known to the court, so that you don't have a situation where a court is just afraid to grant this because it doesn't know for sure that all the heirs are.
Well,
I'd be willing to go that far, but I guess I'm not willing to sort of take them out if you have someone who disagrees.
I think as a practical matter, the court's going to require that anyway. Again, they're going to want some representation from the PR that that these are the people that stand to take under this will, and that these are the people that are on the agreement to waive the bond. You know, the court would do that, I think, on its own.
But I think the language, though, the way the language reads, I'm not sure that all courts would reach that same conclusion. When it says a court may, in its discretion, waive the requirement of a bond if all devisees and heirs agree in writing that the requirement be waived. Where they say, well, that's an absolute standard, what do I do?
Well, the court's still going to want some determination as to who these people are.
Right.
And I think that's built into the language, though. My question, of course, was how do you ever know for sure that everybody is there? You never know for sure until the estate's closed if all the heirs have been contacted. But
again, I think it is probably repetitious. I'm willing to sort of be willing to include the words after heirs on line 24 known to the court. If that would make,
make
you feel comfortable, then and leaving in the other parts of the language would be sufficient then.
Okay, I'll move that amendment.
Great. Senator Shoemaker has moved the addition of the words after the word heirs on line 24, adding the words known to the court. Are there objections to that? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay. The bill as
Senator Shoemaker has moved the House Bill 3089 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please, Senator.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, let us then start down our public hearings. Let's see. 2415. Ron Smith and the executive messengers and Mary Beth Raymond. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up.
Hurry up, hurry up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Smith from Portland, and I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2415. I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Process Servers, the National Association of Professional Process Servers, and I'm on the Educational Committee for the Oregon Association. House Bill 2415 would increase service fees from $15 to $20. The last legislative action designating fees was 8 years ago, and the National Consumer Price Index, as published by the U.S. Department of Commerce, shows a 39.6% increase between 1980 and 1988. The 1980 filing fees for the Tri-County Circuit, District, and Small Claims Courts were $42.50, $22, and $10.80, respectively. Current fees are $104, $72.70, and $36.30. The percentage increase for Circuit Court is 243%, District Court 317%, and small claims increased 335%. The current requested increase to $20 represents less than the Consumer Price Index and pales in comparison to the increased cost of other legal fees. The Oregon Association of Process Servers would like to continue the high quality of service expected of the legal support industry. This measure would go a long way in providing a livable wage for our personnel. Oregon provides a statutory maximum limit of $12.50, and we're not for mileage, and we're not requesting that that be increased.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brenneman.
Let me get this straight then. Right now, if you serve two persons at the same address, it'd be 15, and with this change, it'd be 40.
Two persons at 15, and of course the language in it is for private process services, it's negotiable by contract.
But that what I described would be possible.
I'm sorry?
What I described would be possible. It could go from 15 to 40.
That is correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
When you say $20 for each party at each address for which service is requested, what does that mean?
The original language was $15 for two parties, and what that was the original language, and that would mean that you could serve two parties in the same action at different addresses for the $15, mm-hmm. which means essentially you'd have $7.50 per service if they were at different addresses. The way it's presently worded, you would get to $20 if you went to for each service at two different addresses. Now, as Senator Brenneman said, it is possible to get $40 for serving two people at the same address. However, the open market competition won't allow that. Specifically, that was addressed by several people in committee on the House side, and an amendment was introduced to negotiate for private process service by contract.
Why do we need the language at each address then? If it's $20 for each party served, regardless where, if you have to go to more than one address to serve a party, and they give you several different addresses to try, and that happens occasionally, doesn't
That's
it?
Correct.
Are you to get $20 for each of those addresses that you call upon, or $20 when you finally serve the person wherever he may be?
Yes, I can only speak for myself, and I would interpret that to mean that you get $20 for serving that particular person, regardless of how many attempts you make. As a matter of company policy, we always make attempts at least two locations, regardless of the number. We might make 15 attempts to serve a person, as long as it isn't at more than two locations.
So you'd have no trouble with deleting the language at each address, so that it would read that for serving summons, et cetera, $20 for each party for which service is requested?
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Brockman?
I'm reading the staff measure summary from the House here, and it says, under major points discussed, the market should assist in determining what fee a process server should receive, and then you have concurred with that. It says, thus, a maximum fee should be established, but not a minimum fee. Doesn't this just set a flat fee right here? Were you a party to the proceedings in the House when that issue was brought up?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Well, this just says it's going to be $20. It doesn't say up to.
The continuing language says $20 for each party.